My guest today is Professor Richard Griffiths. We'll be talking about Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, developments, impact, and future implications. Just a few words about my guest to start us off. Professor Griffiths is Emeritus Professor at International Studies at Leiden University in the Netherlands. He worked as a Professor of Economic History at the University of Manchester, the Free University Amsterdam, the European University Institute in Florence. Professor Griffiths graduated from Swansea University College and holds also a PhD in history from Cambridge University. He has published widely on topics ranging from 19th century and 20th century economics development, economic integration, political economy, development economics, small states, and most recently, China's Belt and Road Initiative, the topic of our meeting today. At present, he runs the New Silk Roads Project at the Institute of Asian Studies, which attempts to place the BRI in a relevant comparative context. Professor Griffiths, welcome and thank you for your time.
Thank you, and thank you for having me here.
We'll have, I think, a lot of interesting topics and questions I want to ask you. I think it will be good to start us off with a more general perspective on the Belt and Road Initiative. How do you assess the scope of the Chinese BRI in terms of maybe mostly transportation infrastructure and its influence on the flow of goods in the region or regions?
Okay, well, the Belt and Road, I think, is a very interesting project. It's focused on infrastructure in contrast to many other projects. And it started off with quite a limitation in scale. I mean, it was dedicated initially to the Eurasian continent. It involves, and that's the problem, you're never quite sure whether it involves China financing it, whether it's building it, whether it's owning it, whether it's running it. And more recently, the scope has been expanded to Africa, Latin America. So it's spreading like an ink blot over the geopolitical scene.
Yeah, well, the name of your project is the New Silk Road. So do you mean the different geographical dimensions of the project?
No, actually, I don't. I mean, the problem I find with the analysis of China's Belt and Road is it starts with China. And you almost then get the definition that until China started, there was nothing happening. And except for China, there is nothing happening. And so a road is a road, regardless of who builds it. And once it's built, you travel on the road. So I deliberately use the plural because before China started and since China's been started, other people are building infrastructure. The Asian Development Bank, for example, is almost the most active until China created the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank in actually building infrastructure. Much of the road network in Kazakhstan, for example, was built with the help of the Asian Development Bank and the World Bank, not by China. So if we concentrate on the transport element, China hasn't actually built very much outside China. It's important that contribution was its building inside China because until
linking the existing roads
up to the existing thing. So it's China's been building these its own high-speed rail network. Before that came, freight train would be delayed possibly 3, 4, 5 times on a journey within China before it's even started. So that is a huge increase already in the lowering the costs of transport. It's also very important on the borders. On the two railway crossings in Kazakhstan and the two on Mongolia, China has been instrumental in reinforcing that because you change the gauge of the trains. The trains go on a different gauge, so you have to transfer the containers. China's been investing in that kind of development.
And that's all on the Chinese side.
On Chinese and the border side. Now, there are one or two things. If you want to get oil, for example, or gas from Kazakhstan, then you need a pipeline, and that goes just to China. So China does build infrastructure that brings raw materials to itself, but not so much on the European subcontinent as, say, in Africa, where it owns the mines, builds the railways, develops a port. So to that extent, it does facilitate the transport. For the rest, I think basically my position is China's getting richer. It's exporting more. It's grown 8% a year for 30 years. That is a huge amount of trade. And obviously, most of that goes by sea. So one of the other things China's done is built its own ports. So if you've got a massive increase in trade, you have to have a massive increase potential there. For the rest, I tend to see that China will trade. If China doesn't provide the infrastructure, somebody else will. If the infrastructure is in one place, then the goods will move to another. It's not just China that's involved in building infrastructure. It's not even governments that are involved in building infrastructure.
Okay, so how do you understand the Belt and Road Initiative? Is it an initiative, or should we really talk about a rich, big exporting country just developing naturally the transportation networks and lines and roads?
I think that would be a bit unfair to China. It is an initiative. It's putting the emphasis on infrastructure. One of the big needs of developing countries is roads and railways and bridges and power infrastructure. China's provided a lot of power infrastructure. And it's done that in a sort of Chinese way. We deal government to government. We respect your sovereignty. Basically, I deal with you as a foreign government. I assume you express the wishes of your people. So I don't even have to ask the people what they want. You represent the people. I respect your sovereignty. We negotiate together. Nice, clean agreement. No hassle, no bother. And you, as a government, will say, okay, I'll look at the conditions. What is the conditions of the loans? What is the condition of paying it back?
Read the small print.
Yeah, but don't tell anybody what it is, because there's all sort of confidentiality clauses, and then we'll go ahead. So to that extent, there is more infrastructure being built. So I'm not saying it's not building roads. It is, and it is building railways. But I'm not saying, what I am saying is that they are not really pushing the transport forward. They are possibly helping local development a lot.
Okay, how does it compare with, you mentioned before the infrastructure that was there before and other players. You mentioned the Asian Investment Bank. How about Japan and South Korea? I remember that they were also quite active in especially so Southeast Asia, maybe not, you know.
Well,
not
South Asia, for example, Japan is building high-speed rail in India. You never get that mentioned, but it'll obviously have the same effect on transporting goods as building a high-speed rail in Indonesia. So these things are, as I say, they're made specifically Chinese, and then you forget somebody else is doing the same thing. The high-speed rail in Morocco was built by the French. But, okay.
Well, understandably, they're more active.
Another example is China built a chunk of high-speed rail in Turkey. And it was a difficult part going through tunnels. And if you watch the Chinese TV summary of that, it's part of the Belt and Road. But all the rest of it is built either by Turkey, funded by the European Union. The crossing into Europe is funded by the European Union. We don't say it's all part of Europe, but yet Europe's paid more for that railway than China has. So China puts the focus on its own development, which is what we do as well in the West. Whenever there's an earthquake, you'll see Polish workers first. I'll see the Dutch or the English will be the first ones there. And China does the same. So it highlights its own work very effectively, and it has a very good story that goes with it. We respect you, we give you what you need without any hassle. That's a very attractive story for in the South-South discourse.
Okay, so more than a road, more than a new Silk Road, it's a mosaic of different players, different countries, and China plays an important part in the mosaic, but it's definitely not overpowering the activity of other countries.
No.
Yeah. Right. Okay. We talked a little about Asia and mentioning even Africa, but let's talk about Europe now, the China-Europe railway, because especially in Poland, where we have geographically a very important possibly position, there's been a lot of talk about Poland being a very important player in the transportation of goods through railway between China and Western Europe. And we've heard different stories and we know different things about how that has happened or has not happened. I want to ask you about, first of all, the practical side of things, not the political side of things. You know, we know how big container ships are. How much can really rail transport matter in Chinese sort of needs, transportation needs, both in and out of the country?
That's a good question. The trains, when they get to Europe, are 750 meters long. They can take 40 large shipping containers each. The trains start off in China, and usually they're different cities in China have negotiated bilateral routes, and they're called so many routes, but they're not regular routes. It's an agreement that goods from Chengdu will end up in Madrid, for example.
On one-off basis.
On one-on-one. And that might happen once a month. It might happen once every 2 or 3 months. The Chinese government endorses this. It relabeled the whole thing the China-Europe Express. It's opened up with a big fanfare, nice banners, etc. But it's really the cities that are competing with each other for that trade. and they offer discounts for the trade. And the Chinese government is trying to say, okay, we like this, but let's stop the subsidies. So they want to phase those out. Let's apply the subsidies only to full trains. So missing containers, no subsidies, no guarantee the containers are full. But I was in Chengdu. I mean, I was teaching there, and we were taken to the China Europe Center. It's a beautiful white building, lovely, and all modcons inside, state of the art. And they said with great pride, this is the China Europe Center, and it was going to be the local government center, but we had competition. So I said, oh, you had competition from Chongming? No, we had competition from the other side of Chengdu.
Oh,
for the building of this. So there really is a friction there. So China sends goods out, more goods than it gets back, but that's part of China's trade imbalance with the West anyway. And the goods that go there, it's more expensive than going by sea, but it's faster.
But you said 40 containers on a train, and it's
40 full length. I mean, there'll be 80 odd if you use the smaller containers you see on trucks.
Yeah, but it's about 10,000 on a ship.
23,000 on the larger ships.
Okay, 23,000. Okay, so it's a huge difference.
Yeah, the latest information that was last year is China says that about 8% of its trade by value goes on the trains. Now, that amount by train has gone up because of the problems with the sea transport and with the COVID, and the problem amount by sea has gone down. So, and it's by value, not by volume. So by value, you've got more valuable goods in one of those containers than the ones going by sea. So my guess is around 5% of China-Europe trade goes on those railways.
Okay, so if we imagine that 95% goes still through the Malacca Strait, probably?
Yep.
Virtually everything, yeah? Because yes, the northern route, I understand, is not really navigable.
No, you can't use the northern route for major trade
okay,
at the moment.
So if you export goods from China and you export them to Africa, Europe, Americas, then you have to go through the...
Well, not to America.
Okay, but not to America. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so you have to go through the Malacca Strait, you have to go through the Indian Ocean, up through the Suez Canal, round through the Mediterranean, and it'll take you about 4 weeks.
Yeah, but it's still 95%. So why is the land route so important for China so that it develops the, you know, big capacity organizationally?
Well, if the goods are higher value, you don't really want your computer thing sitting in a container on a ship for 4 weeks. It ties up your capital because you can't sell it till it gets to the other side. So it goes quicker, which means that you can realize the things of a just-in-time systems of production or of sales.
Are they still... I'm thinking about COVID. I'm thinking about all the delays. Well, is the just-in-time idea being maybe...
It's being heavily eroded.
Yeah.
I mean, it's 500,000 containers just waiting to be delivered from Shanghai at the moment. So it's huge disruptions. The fare of... it used to cost to send a shipping container from China to Rotterdam, for example, under $2,000. Now, if you're considering at about 30 tons in one of those containers, that is cheap. Now, there are other costs that go on top of that, putting it on the ship, moving it off, all the others, but that's pure shipping cost. Whereas the cost of sending it over land would be at least 3-4 times that, but you get the beneficial effect of the timing. If you really are desperate now, you can send it by air freight, you'll pay 10 times that sort of price. But now the cost of a shipping container has gone up to 10,000. I mean, really are very, very high. And so now if you can do it, it's probably competitive as well to send it by rail.
Okay, so we talked about the economic financial aspect. Is there a geopolitical aspect? Is this a way of possibly creating alternatives for the Malacca Strait?
No, it's not large enough volume going through. It's highly specialized trade. And it has one big shortcoming. Most of that journey, or at least a chunk of that journey, is on Russian railways. And given the attitude between Europe and Russia at the moment, given the Kaliningrad blockade that's only just being put in, I am not sure at what stage either Russia or Europe will start intervening on that rail route.
Right.
And at that stage, the game changes automatically.
So we're still on the sea freight most of all?
I think we're on sea freight most of all, yeah.
Yeah, and we keep this as an alternative for some of the goods
and
some of the conditions.
Yep.
Okay, so we talked about rail transport. Let's try to think about the maritime Silk Road and maybe the Indian Ocean. What is China doing there? What are the activities? What are the strategies?
scaring India. That's what it's doing. Okay, there, well, for certain.
But this is interesting because, you know, very often in Europe, we especially in the US, there is this black and white narrative, and you know, imagining China as working very closely with Russia, with India, and we just know how complicated the relations are.
I think the easiest thing to explain, because there is an image problem there, and India shares the sort of China challenge equals China threat equals something that's in the security field. That's the logical steps. And the discussion goes that way in India too. There are three headline ports. There's Gwadar in Pakistan, the pearl of the Indian Ocean, or the pearl of the Chinese economic corridor, China-Pakistan economic corridor. The word pearl is interesting because of this string of pearls idea promoted by the United States, that this is a set of...
Which is
of
not very friendly for China, is it?
No. So there it is, the pearl of the CPEC. Its idea is to get goods down from Kashgar down into the Indian Ocean. Now, if you look at where Kashgar is at the bottom of Xinjiang and you push it halfway across China, in fact, all the way across China, then put it on that sea journey to get it all the way back to almost where it started, you can see that there's a logic to building a port there to get goods from inside China. Almost next door in Iran, India is building a port of Chabahar to get goods from Uzbekistan and Afghanistan, avoiding Pakistan. So the logic is almost parallel. Gwadar is three cranes, a bit of a building site. Hardly any ships go there.
Why is that?
Why would you go there?
Okay. So the volume of trade is not
almost
impressive.
Zero at the moment. China shows a great deal of interest in improving the connection. It's building a road going from Gwadar to Karachi, going in the wrong direction. It's not building it north-south, which would be the logical thing, and then it links up to the rest of the network. So if China was serious about this, it would be building a railway up north. It would be building a road up north. It would really be promoting this port. It isn't. It's lying there. It's a threat. It's perceived as much bigger than it is. What's never in the news is that China is helping to develop and wanting to develop Karachi. Now, Karachi, about 80-90% of the goods go either through Karachi or Port Qasim. And China's saying, all right, let's reclaim land on the other side. It's short of land. Let's get some land there and build more ports and a financial city there. The World Bank says, fabulous, let's increase the size there, build a nice motorway out that avoids the congestion. Karachi is the port being built up, with both China and the World Bank considering how best to do it at this very moment, whilst everybody's staring over their shoulders saying, Gwadar is a huge security threat. The second port is Hambantota, which is in Sri Lanka. Again, predates the Belt and Road. It was a pet project of the then Prime Minister. This is his area. He wanted to build it up, cricket stadium, airport, library, hospital, port. It's part of the debt bondage story. It is the headline case of the debt bondage story. Sri Lanka gets into debt problems. China says, okay, we'll waive some of the debts if we get a lease on the port. So it's got a lease on the port. What does it do? Very little. I'll tell my student, anybody's interested, it's a car park. There's a lot of land, not many people, not much of a market, but big ships, they've got huge ships that take cars. They're offloaded in Hambantota, reloaded onto smaller vessels and shipped around the Indian Ocean area.
To
Pakistan, you name it, Bangladesh, the whole region. So in a way, it performs the same role as Colombo, which is the main port. 90% of the trade goes through Colombo. Most of it, again, as a hub. Colombo is a deep harbor port. It's pushed, it then gets sold further out. China is building an industrial financial city next to Colombo. Hambantota is the headline here. Not really doing much. As I say, it's a car park.
So why? My question is why? Why does China invest in ports where it actually doesn't do much?
Well, it is moving cars now. If you want to move cars, you'd say, okay, where do you move cars from? I mean, I bet you don't know the biggest car port in the world.
No, I've no idea.
Zeebrugge in Belgium. Yeah, it's not in Hamburg, it's not in Bremerhaven, it's Zeebrugge, boof. So you need a large bit of land, cheap drivers, just put the things on and off the things, and that's it. So somewhere it has to be, and it better out if you haven't got a city. Well, this is on the edge of a jungle. You can have all the cars in the world going there and still have room left over. So that's that port. Then there's one other in Myanmar called Khao Phu. I've probably got the pronunciation wrong. Again, predates China's Belt and Road. Everybody says it's to avoid the Malacca Straits. This is the headline port of this is the way to avoid the Malacca Straits because it can get the goods straight up to Kunming. China got the port because it bought a gas field nearby. So the first thing was to offload the gas from the gas field and a pipeline up. It managed to get permission to put a petrol line up as well to get oil, crude oil up there. So it does avoid the Strait of Malacca. It wants a railway, hasn't got it yet, and it wanted a port. It's just got permission for a 1 million container port. It's not large, but it's a step in the right direction, whether it will end up building it or not. But again, will it avoid this Straits of Malacca dilemma, or is that the purpose? No. If you want to get goods up to Kunming, then it's easier to get it that way than to go right the way around the Straits of Malacca, back up the other side where you've got 7,000 kilometres already done, then travel across the country to do a longer journey across country than you would have done if you'd done it in the first place. So many of these port developments, successful or not, make economic sense. And yet, because it's China, it automatically gets a twist that puts it as a challenge. From the challenge, it becomes a threat. From the threat, it becomes a potential for something else. Well, every deep harbor port can have a submarine. It's a potential, yeah. So I confess, if I were talking about Germany in the 1930s, I would have said, these autobahns are a good idea. They'll help the future of trade. And I would have been completely wrong. So if I'm completely wrong, I apologize. But as I say, as a historian, when it's already happened, I'll explain that is why nothing else could have happened.
But it's really interesting because I think from a international relations point of view, people look at the geopolitical perspective. They don't look at the pragmatic perspective. And I see that the pragmatic perspective and the sort of logic of trade and transportation is paramount here.
It's not just countries that build ports, port development. Sometimes ports are built by foreign port owners. They say, okay, we'll run a port. That's our business. Dubai World is DP. Dubai Port World is one of them. Hutchison is Hong Kong based.
So they just private, build ports
and they
money.
Run it. Private money, private thing, they'll build it. Sometimes a shipping company wants it. Maersk has got an arm that builds a port. Costco does it too. And it says because we can get more of the value chain if we control that bit.
Like with air transportation, DHL.
But why, if you build a port, you tie up the money in that port, you could easily have had more ships with it. So you have to make a balance of how much do you want in ships, how much do you want in ports. If you really want to be transporting, and nobody really mentions that, the biggest contribution of China to Chinese trade is Chinese ships.
Yeah.
But it's never mentioned at all.
Okay. Yeah. Really interesting. Okay. Well, I want to proceed to something that is even more, I think, or maybe less discussed, at least as far as I'm aware. That's the ecological side or the biodiversity side. And actually, you did publish very recently, I will just show this, a newly published book on the Belt and Road and the biodiversity dimension. It's available online through online bookstores in electronic form. I really want to ask you about this because, you know, we already talked about these trade, political dimensions, et cetera, et cetera. Now, how does Chinese activity, you know, under the umbrella of the Belt and Road Initiative, how does it influence the environment in the places where China is investing?
Okay, I think, again, you're doing what I accuse people of doing. How does infrastructure influence ecology? And how does China...
Is it any different from other countries and other players investing?
Well, yes and no. As I say, China does state-to-state negotiations. It respects your laws, your regulations, and it's not going to interfere. It's not going to layer another layer of environmental expectations across. So if you say this is our law, China will generally respect it, it depends on the enforcement, it'll go ahead. So it will not layer another layer of environmental control on top of the national control already, but it's no worse than anybody else following the same rules. I'm going to give you one example of this, because I was working on the Indian Ocean thing, and they're building a port in Myanmar in Madabari, and they want to build that into a big port. Why do they want it? Because the Japanese are building a power station there, and it's going to import coal, so it might as well import containers. That's the development. Greenpeace did a survey of all Japanese coal-fired power stations in the area, and it discovered that none of them satisfy Japan's environmental criteria. So the fact that you give enterprise a bit of leeway to bend whatever rules are around, China will do it, other countries do it too. So I've used that as an example. So the question is, how much does infrastructure affect the environment? And I've been writing most of my career, oh, well, roads are good. You know, you've just been listening to me. Roads are good. Do it better. Helps transport, helps development. I went to this conference in Kunming, and it was run by these environmentalists. I realized that my roads and my railways have been stamping over the environment in a terrible way. So we got together and we published the book. And I think I can take some of the examples of how it affects. We all like green power, windmills and solar. But windmills, they're huge. You're taking tons and tons of material. So to build a park anywhere, you're going to have to build a huge road to get to the place. As soon as you build a road, you split whatever environment there is. So for creatures really to survive, you need a large, intact environment. On the outside, then it degenerates or gets worse as the sun and the wind hits it. So if you put a road through the middle, you don't just cut it in half. You start the process again on either side of the road. So the quality of the environment automatically goes down, and therefore the risk to whatever creatures are in it goes down. In addition, you bring in invasives. And the biggest invasive is us.
Yeah, well, we are quite invasive. Yeah,
yeah. But there's a nice road. Well, let's build a house near it. Let's have a little town next door to it, and slowly we'll gobble up whatever's around. So we are a danger, but you've given us access to it. Another green element, and I'm pleased to say we're downplaying it, hydroelectricity. Hydroelectricity, you build a dam and you get the water that you put through the hydro thing. You don't want it full of muck or anything else. So it's clean water. It's cold water. It's dead water. And you pump that through the turbines and along the river. So the river has to start again, accumulating all the goodnesses that get moved down rivers.
Okay, so it's not only the volume of water, but it's also the
character of the water, yeah.
Okay, I remember the Chinese hydroelectricity plants on the Mekong.
That's one of the great stories. Yeah. And again, the degeneration of the river. So one of the biggest problems you get, one of the most endangered sorts of species at the moment, are fresh sea and freshwater fish, are one of the most endangered group because of the quality of both. And then I did the chapter on ports. Now, ports are great. They're at sea level. Sea levels are rising. Right. Once you start controlling the port, you start controlling the land next to it. And as soon as you carry on doing that, you can destroy an entire coastal ecostructure. And so it goes on. And the point is, it's not helpful to focus on China. It is helpful to say we need to be more careful. I'm not saying you don't do any of these things, but there are ways of avoiding or minimizing the damage. So, for example, if you have a wind turbine station, right, it kills birds. Birds go into it, kills bats. Well, try and build it away from known flight paths of birds. There are known migratory paths of birds. Don't put it in the way. Switch them off at night if you've got bat colonies so the bats don't go into them. I mean, there are all sorts of measures you can take that minimize the damage, but you have to realize that as we put our footprint on the earth, then we remove it from other people. And one of the projects we have at the moment at Leiden, a rare earth project, which we have also under our flag, they're working with us. And I'm working on deep sea mining at the moment.
That sounds scary also.
Well, it is scary. It's really scary. There's a moratorium on deep sea mining at the moment, 2 years, but one specific island with a population of 12,000 people has said, we want to start mining. So we now have 2 years to get the rules fixed. And my argument is we've got 2 years to get to stop the thing altogether. We don't know what's happening down there. We're talking 3, 4, 5 kilometers under the sea. We just don't know what the ecosphere is there. We haven't examined the life forms. We don't know what it involves. And these, I've been reading the research, these are connected so that if we kill one off, we might affect others. It's not that you could just isolate it. And they're going to go churning up the seabed, the sediment will layer down, bury whatever nutrition is there. So these are all developments where we are very fast. But the latest panel on climate change, you're going, well, there's calculations, you're going to need an annual increase of some of these rare metals of up to 7-8 times what it is at the moment. So for the batteries, for the generators, everything else. So deep sea mining is a very attractive option for doing it. And there's a bit pressure there, but we'll be killing off a life system that we know nothing about.
Okay, so listening to you, I'm thinking about the issue that you raised before about the national regulations and who is to actually regulate this. If we have companies, and then you are right, we don't need to talk about China specifically, but we have big money and we have big industrial needs, and we have the ability to limit the effect of investments on the environment, but who would want to limit the profits?
Well, that's a big problem. There has been a convention protecting biodiversity with 20 international targets, none of which have been met. Reason why I was in Kunming is the Chinese were planning to host the biodiversity conference in Kunming. It's now going to go to Montreal, I think, at the end of this year. The point with biodiversity is you don't need international rules because they are different. I mean, preserving birds are different from preserving animals, preserving jungles, which are one of the other areas, jungles and mountains, where we don't really know what there is. And there are studies that say probably creatures are disappearing at a faster rate than we're registering them. And add climate change on that mix. So what you need are very detailed local targets that are, if necessary, limited to a species or limited to a certain area.
So we need a government that is willing to enforce these laws or create them first.
To create them and to enforce them. And to be honest, China is moving forward in its own regulations there as well. So, I mean, it's easy to paint it black, but one of the reasons why the pandas, for example, are actually not dying out is the measures that are being taken by the Chinese government. And China doesn't have to take measures for penguins or for elephants. It hasn't got any. So this is what
it
I mean.
It used to have elephants.
I know.
loads. Several thousand years ago.
Loads of them. Yeah, it did in the south there.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Okay, that's fascinating. So we ended on a hopeful note.
Watch the news in December and see if there are interesting developments from it. I'm pessimistic, but
hopefully there will be also some good developments, not only the bad ones. Okay, so we did talk about different aspects of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. Thank you very much for all your insightful contributions, and I hope you do some more research so that we can have books like this, which I think
can
is interesting.
Can I make one little advert based on that book? I've created a website called Resources for Climate Change, and it's number 4. So it's resources and then number 4, climatechange.com. And we've got e-libraries there where you can read many of these originals. We've got thematic things, deep sea mining, the Mekong, the Amazon, various aspects, specific libraries. You can go and read the things. You don't even have to leave your computer. You don't have to go to So that's up there. There's artwork up there as well. So if anybody feels attracted to shed some art for us, then we'll put it online as well.
Okay, I'll definitely check
it out. And that's the add-on to the book.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for sharing this.
Thank you.
Professor Griffiths, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
My guest today was Professor Richard Griffiths, Professor at International Studies at Leiden University, Netherlands. Thank you.